treat her right. Mother, I always love her. My mother, so treat her right, treat her right.
I like to listen to music at all. After I have a hit of my phone, of my phone, of my phone. I like to listen to music at all. After I have a hit of my phone, of my phone, of my phone. I like to listen to sick and wrong after I have a hit of my bong bong. If I need to write a song, but it didn't take me very long. Well, now's the end. Yeah. Oh, Adam and Eve, Eve.com. Yeah. I like to listen to sick and wrong after I have a hit of my bong, of my bong, of my bong. I like to listen to sick and wrong after I have a hit of my bong, of my bong.
Good evening. Welcome to Sick and Wrong, the world's source for antisocial commentary. I'm one of your hosts, E. Simon.
Hi, I'm Kate Rambo. Word to your mother. Hiya.
Kate Rambo.
Yeah?
Speaking about mothers, why do the English celebrate Mother's Day
first
in March?
Because we invented the day, probably, and you guys do it wrong. Like, you do a lot of things wrong. Like, why do you write the dates backwards? That's not how we taught you.
Yeah, but the real Mother's Day is supposed to be in May.
No, it's March.
March is too close to Valentine's Day, so that means you got to go get. Do you on Valentine's Day? Do you get your mother flowers and then in chocolates? Then you buy her flowers again on Mother's Day?
No, why would you buy? Like, I'm from the north, but I'm not that inbred. I don't get a Valentine's Day present.
I used to get my mom flowers on Valentine's Day.
You wee souk.
Yeah. Why not? She liked it.
Yeah, but you basically that's a day for lovers.
I would get her red roses. I would get her like some, I don't know, some kind of flowers, like lilies or something she liked.
Yeah, but you wait to do that till the next month.
Well, I would do it in February, and then 3 months later in May, I'd get her flowers again.
See, mothers have it made, don't they?
Well, I just, you know, I looked this up because I'm like, why do they celebrate Mother's Day
in
March in the
correct.
UK? And then, you know, it's celebrated the second Sunday in May. Or the second Sunday in May in the U.S. So it was March, I think, 10th this year in the U.K. And then it was May 12th today in the U.S. So I was looking into this. I'm like, why do they do this? So Mother's Day is celebrated in the U.S., India, Canada, Australia, and most of Europe today, May 12th.
Seriously? Even in Australia?
Yeah, even Australia and Canada. Weird. We're part of the Commonwealth, right?
Yeah, that's weird.
So weird.
Turncoats.
But Mother's Day was celebrated in the UK on the 10th of March this year. So in the UK, the day is also known as Mothering Day.
Well, Mothering Sunday.
Mothering Sunday.
Yeah.
And so the UK date in March is rooted in the Christian observance of Lent. So Mothering Sunday takes place on the fourth Sunday, 3 weeks before Easter Sunday.
All right.
But Mother's Day began in America in 1907. I guess this woman named Anna Jarvis, who was a daughter of a peace activist who treated wounded soldiers in the American Civil War, she campaigned for a day to honor the role played by mothers. And she observed the second Sunday in May because that's when she held a service to honor her mother when her mother died.
Hang on, Anna. Anna must have known that there was already a day in Britain that was honoring mothers. So why wasn't she like, well, we already know Britain does it. Let's just copy them.
I don't think they knew that Britain did it, because I think Britain did their own thing. And then the US were like, well, we don't have a Mother's Day. So Anna was like, let's just do a Mother's Day here.
She must have known. There's no way the Irish were coming over here and not being like, well, we're still going to love our mothers on Mothering Sunday.
Well, the idea took off. And by 1911, all U.S. states took on the holiday. And then President Woodrow Wilson in 1914 officially stated it's a holiday held second Sunday in May.
So, you know, we talk about worst presidents, most racist, terrible presidents. You might think of Trump, but it's actually Woodrow Wilson. What a terrible human being of a man.
But what a great name.
And you know where his mother was born?
Where?
Carlisle. It makes sense.
We've talked about him before.
Makes sense why he's a racist little prick, because his generation is from Carlisle.
So ironically, you know, Anna Jarvis founded the holiday, but then she grew strongly opposed to it becoming commercialized. And then she campaigned to stop Mother's Day.
Anna's a fucking... What is wrong with Anna? She's
well,
up
I think
her
she
own
created
ass.
This thing. She's like, you know, we should have a day to honor mothers.
Well, she didn't create it because it already existed.
Well,
she
created it in the U.S.
She stole
and
an
so
idea.
She created it in the U.S. and she was all about it. And then all of a sudden people were like, well, no, we can, you know, we can sell Hallmark cards and we can get roses and chocolates and all this. And she was against that.
Why?
And so she was against Mother's Day. I wouldn't mind if she just, you know, stopped it entirely. But countries that joined the UK that to celebrate Mother's Day on the fourth Sunday of Lent. Nigeria.
Okay.
And Ireland.
Okay. Scotland too.
Most countries around the world follow America's lead in celebrating the holiday on the second Sunday in May.
Well, you're all idiots. Do it in March. Russia, get it over and done with.
Russia, Vietnam, and Afghanistan actually mark the occasion on International Women's Day.
Oh, I like that.
Which is in March. In France, it's typically celebrated the last Sunday of May.
Okay.
But they'll move it to the first Sunday of June if it coincides with Pentecost Day.
You know, honestly, I used to say this to my mom. I'd be like, why don't we get a National Children's Day? And she'd be like, every day is Children's Day.
All parents say that.
It's like, well, don't have children if you're going to be passive aggressive with me.
Well, all parents say that.
It should be there should be a National Child Day where it's like, you should give thanks. On Mother's Day, in fact, and Father's Day, we'll lump it in. You should be giving your child a gift. Because you would not be a mother if it was not for your child.
Well, I think the reverse is true.
I'm spinning it around.
Because they gave you life.
Yeah, but they wouldn't even be a mother if it wasn't for you.
Yeah, but she could just have another one of you.
That would be cool. I would also want a gift for that.
She could adopt one. She could adopt another child.
That child should also get a present.
The idea is you're supposed to honor your mother for raising you.
Well,
you're
sometimes they don't
ingrate.
Do.
You are an ingrate.
I just want it paid back.
I can't
back.
Believe your mother didn't disown you.
I just want it paid back. When do I get my, like,
yeah,
you know?
Your fucking birthday or anytime you call her and you
Everyone
need something.
Everyone has a birthday.
For 18 years, you got it back.
Well, that was her choice to have a child.
Well, no, she's your mother.
I didn't ask to be born, David.
She's your mother. That's what it's all about. And you are an ingrate. And if I were your mother, I would disown you.
So are you jealous? Because I still have a mother. Hey,
that hit close to home. You know what's interesting, though, is after it was celebrated as Mother's Day here and other countries started celebrating Mother's Day, England was like, you know what? We're just going to go with Mother's Day rather than Mothering Sunday.
Some people, my mom still calls it Mothering Sunday.
But they kind of changed it. So most people now do Mother's Day. So okay. Who copied who?
That's
what I'm saying. So this week's show, we're going to honor mothers everywhere by discussing the story of a mother named Barbara Daly Bakeland, who loved her son Tony so much. She loved him so much. This is like a true story of a mother's love, that she attempted to cure his homosexuality by forcing him to sleep with her.
Oh, is she hot?
She's really hot.
Oh, okay.
She's a model.
This makes it even sexier.
Well, it didn't work out as planned.
Obviously.
And Tony stabbed her to death. But this story truly represents a steadfast bond a mother has with her child. So before we get into that, let's chat about a podcast that I feel every mother should make their kid listen to during their formative years. Sick and Wrong Patron. So if you listen to this show every week and you love what Kate and I do here, all we ask is that you sign up for Patron, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, and just support the show. Do your part to keep the show going. It's only $5 a month. That's really not that much money. I mean, it's less than a beer.
Yeah, nowadays.
And for $5, you get access to Sick and Wrong's second show. Every week, we do a second show. It's a bit more saucy, a bit more salacious, a bit more personal. This week on the second show, you can hear me rant about having to plan a baby shower for a coworker.
Yeah, if you want to hear it, like a Jew get upset.
WTF. Capitals. Like, how did this happen? I don't know. We also chatted about getting drunk last night at the Echo while checking out Kate's new favorite band. And we give you an update on my brother's teeth.
It's
or
all
lack
going
thereof.
On. And we play the rest of Dan from Illinois'
calls.
Oh, yeah.
Dan's, the second part of Dan's call, which he covers some pretty provocative topics. So $5 a month. That's it. $5 a month to get access to Sick and Wrong on Patreon, and you get access to the official Sick and Wrong Discord. And you don't even need to sign up for Patreon. You can just do it right through Apple Podcasts. Go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe to Second Show. We do appreciate you keeping it sick and wrong every week. Patreon.com/sickandwrong. So let me play this quick promo, and then let's chat about a mother's unrequited love for her son.
Greetings, loyal subjects in the UK and in the colonies. I love the Sick and Wrong Patreon. It gives me news stories, extra phone calls, and lots of tips on how to deal with my son Andrew, the sweaty nonce. anybody found in the UK or the colonies not subscribed to the Patreon will face beheading. Thank you.
So, Kay Rambo, have you ever heard of this woman, Barbara Daly Bakeland?
I don't think so, otherwise I had known that she was hot to begin with.
Well, it's from, she was kind of famous like in the 40s. Ooh, she was a New York socialite. But so Barbara was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, September 28th, 1921. She was raised by her mother, Nina, who was affectionately known as Nini, and her father, Frank.
Great
up
name.
Until the age of 11, 1933, Frank took his own life. He wanted to make it look like an accident, so that his wife and daughter could cash in and claim his life insurance. So he ended up pretty much sucking on exhaust fumes in his car. But apparently back then, if you had life insurance, you could still cash in. The family could. I don't think now, if they prove it's a suicide, you're not getting anything.
Well, I think now you could only do that death if you have a classic car.
Yeah, you'd have to have a vintage car. You're not going to be able to do it in a Prius.
Bring it back, I say. Bring back the, if you want to end your life in, like, because that way really hurts no one, does it?
It's a great way to go.
It's a nice, peaceful way to go. You just fucking fall asleep, you know, that's it. That's you done for.
It's, yeah. I mean, I think it's painless. You know, you could drink a fifth of whiskey, some good whiskey, and just die in your car. Why not?
Anne Sexton, just while we're here, Anne Sexton was also a mother who touched her kids, but she was the one who, like, was a poet laureate, and she used to be like, Sylvia Plath stole my suicides. She's fucking stole them. But she attempted suicide 9 times.
9 times.
9 times before that trick worked. She got into her car and did the exhaust. Great poet. Much better than Sylvia Plath.
So the father took his own life, committed suicide, and the mother, Nini here, had a nervous breakdown a few years before Barbara was even born. And Barbara definitely inherited her mother's genetics, and she was prone to erratic behavior and depressive behavior. So through her childhood, Barbara was well aware that the parents had a difficult relationship, especially concerning mental health. But at the time, people didn't really talk about mental health issues.
Oh, no, of course not.
Yeah, I don't even think people really went to psychiatrists. I think it was...
Well, they did. There was, analysts was a big popular thing in the
1920s. People did, but I don't think you were very open about, I'm going to therapy,
now. Absolutely not.
So, you know, most people didn't usually go seek assistance, even if they knew that they probably should. So once Frank's affairs were settled, and Nini and Barbara got a huge life insurance policy, they ended up moving to New York City, where they settled into the Delmonico Hotel.
Oh, nice.
A very nice hotel. And so Barbara grew up in affluence. I mean, she was a New York socialite. She loved the attention. She was very attractive. She started modeling for Vogue and Harper's Bazaar.
Oh.
Yeah, when she was in her late teens. And her looks caught the attention of many Hollywood directors. So she was invited to L.A. to perform a screen test with a renowned actor at the time, Dana Andrews. So I had to look up. I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, but I might know him to see.
He was a major star in like the film noir.
Yeah, I think I know him to see.
So leading man during the 40s. He did continue to act in lesser known parts all the way up into the 1980s. But he's best known for his portrayal of obsessed police detective Mark McPherson in the noir Laura.
Oh, fucking, I love that movie. Yeah. Okay, I know him.
He was also in he played a World War II veteran, Fred Derry, in The Best Years of Our Lives. I don't know that movie, though.
I feel like I know it, but I've probably not seen it.
Well, Barbara was hoping she'd become a famous actress because she's beautiful and she's invited out to Hollywood. But she didn't do all that well in the audition.
Oh, no.
But all was not lost. She ended up meeting another aspiring actress there named Cornelia Bakeland. Cornelia Dickey Bakeland. I do love how back then women could just, that's a nickname for women. Dickey.
I love it. Maybe I'll start calling myself Dickey.
Cornelia Dickey Bakeland. She met her, and then she found out she must have known who she was because the Bakelands were a famous household name, namely because Cornelia's grandfather was famous chemist Leo Bakeland, who was the inventor of Bakelite.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the substance that became the first synthetic plastic.
Now major collective vintage items, Bakelite handbags, Bakelite bangles.
So the Bakelands were very wealthy.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty obvious. So Dickie introduced Barbara to her brother, Brooks, because they're hanging out all the time. And Brooks was this dashing trainee pilot with the Royal Canadian Air Force. And Barbara was like, I'm going to marry this guy. She saw fame. She saw fortune. She saw a life of luxury. I mean, this guy was, you know, the inheritor of a huge fortune. And so she was determined to get a piece of that. So I think the other thing, too, is she kind of wanted to be a celebrity couple. I mean, this family was kind of like, just a famous Hollywood family.
It also makes sense if she's a socialite.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she was either going to go back to New York and marry somebody else who was rich. I don't know, maybe the guy who invented Post-its. Or she was going to stay in L.A. and marry the guy who invented Bakelite. Like,
well, the grandson of the guy that invented Bakelite. But, I mean, they're both really good looking. They both had a lot of money. And Brooks was an inheritor of his grandfather's estate. So
did Brooks know she's fucking mental, though?
No, not at the time.
Yeah, pure Brooks.
So the couple ended up getting married in California in the early 1940s. Brooks wasn't too into the marriage. Like, he was like, Barbara kept bringing it up because Barbara really wanted him to put a ring on it. And he did enjoy her company, and obviously she was beautiful, but he wasn't too keen on that kind of commitment. But then when she said, I'm pregnant,
oh no,
he decided to do the right thing. But he didn't learn until after they got married that Barbara made up the pregnancy.
Barbara.
Deceived him.
Oh, she did.
Yeah. And, it was kind of a honey trap. She wanted this lifestyle. And in order to trap him, she's going to have to say she had a baby.
You know what, though? They were obviously having sex, which... like, it wasn't taboo. They were all fucking back then. Like, it's, everyone was fucking. But he maybe did it to just be like, okay, I know you were an honest woman and I've been sticking my dick in you all this time. So maybe I've been getting the cow for free and now, like, yeah.
Well, he must have found out, though, that this is a ruse.
Oh, yeah, eventually. But he was obviously banging her in the back of his jalopy or back of his Ford Mustang.
Well, despite the deception, he stayed married to her. And then the couple relocated from California to the Upper East Side of New York City. And there they partied, like, with the elites of New York. They had huge parties with different guests, Greta Garbo, Tennessee Williams, William Styron, just a lot. They were definitely hobnobbing with some famous people at the time.
Fun.
And so prior to going out to California to try to become an actress, Barbara was well known in New York for her expressive, if not somewhat quirky, personality. Friends knew that she was prone to outbursts. She did a lot of drinking. And she had bouts of severe depression.
She sounds kind of fun so far.
She's mental. And though Brooks was becoming more, you know, aware of her mental health issues, he made Barbara seek out mental health support. But it didn't do all that much. And they were even going to couples therapy, but it didn't really help the situation. And I mean, they had the appearance of a happy marriage, like superficially, but they definitely weren't picture perfect. I mean, Brooks had a lot of extramarital affairs that Barbara was well aware of. Barbara is also very competitive, and Barbara had extramarital affairs.
Yeah.
So both of them were cheating on each other.
Yeah, this is really reminding me of Anne Sexton and her husband.
Well, August 28th, 1946, Barbara gave birth to their only child, Anthony Tony Bakeland, who she was hoping would save their marriage, bring them close.
Barbara, no, a baby will never save your marriage. If anything, babies make marriages worse.
Well, she doted on her son. She loved her son. And Brooks, you know, showed him off to his friends as though, you know, Tony was like a trophy. He was very proud of his son. And in 1954, a few years later, when Tony was 8, the Bakelands were like, you know what? We're done with New York City. We're going to travel the world. They kept their apartment there. This is how great it would be to be wealthy.
Yeah.
They kept their apartment in New York, and then they just traveled through Europe, renting houses and villas in different cities. Italy and London and Paris and Switzerland.
It's getting too cold here, darling.
Yeah, let's just move on. I'm bored.
It's a bit cold here. We're going to Greece next, shall we? Yes. Pack up the Hermes luggage.
And this nomadic lifestyle obviously kind of exacerbated their socializing, their entertaining, their drinking, and the many, many affairs.
Yeah. Oh, well, now you can go across Europe shagging.
So Tony was a very curious and artistic child. He was very smart. They said he was a prodigy. And Barbara encouraged him to paint and to write. And Brooks encouraged him to do his scientific experiments. I guess the kid was really into science.
Okay.
But a lot of his experiments involved harming insects and small animals.
I was about to say, did his scientific experiments also involve over men's dicks?
Well, later. But I mean, he's like a 10-year-old kid at this point. So,
he's a bit Jeffrey Dahmer-y.
Exactly. Yeah. Little baby Dahmer. So adorable. And the parents didn't even find anything, you know, remotely disconcerting about him torturing small animals. He's like, yeah, boys will be boys.
I think it was a little bit different back then as well. Because you'd be like, oh, he's just, you know, he's interested in like ornithological studies.
Well, I think that's what Brooks, the father, thought. So around 1960, the Bakelands ended up settling in Paris. What's funny about this couple, too, is like neither one of them had to work.
It was fab.
I mean, he lived off his trust from the Bakelaid family, and
so
they just
good.
Lived around the world in different... So, I mean, they pretty much just stayed in different cities, fucked whoever they wanted to. You wonder who raised the kid.
I was going to say, I know obviously her job would have been child rearing, but she's doing fuck all of that. But what was he... What was Brooks? Was he like... publishing papers or anything like that?
I think he was just
like
a socialite.
Was he a stocksman? Did he have like racehorses?
I think he was just a socialite.
Oh,
just
wow.
Living off his parents' money.
Like, was he not a philanthropist?
I mean, I'm sure they had some kind of front.
That's
to make it
I'm
look like he was
for.
Doing something legitimate. But yeah. I think pretty much this guy was partying.
Partying,
fucking, and traveling around the world. Why not?
That. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong, but like, look at Errol Flynn. You're going to fucking die well before your time.
Well, so they settle in Paris. They thought having, you know, settling down, finding an apartment that they live in, this huge apartment, would improve Barbara's mental health and, you know, kind of maintain this image, this facade of a happy marriage. On more than one occasion, Brooks was over it. He couldn't deal with her anymore. And every time... he would mention that he was considering a divorce or even bring up the topic, Barbara would threaten to take her life.
I mean, you got to think, though, like, back then, it wasn't very good to be a woman. Like, Barbara was never getting her pussy eaten by her husband.
Well, she might have by her many paramours.
Maybe, but, like, yeah, good. Like, if your husband's not going to eat your fucking pussy, go elsewhere to get it done. I mean, he was probably gaslighting her in this couple's therapy, where it's like, men can do what men can do.
Well, he was probably like, I'm married to her, she's the mother of my child, but she's a mentalist. I'm not even attracted to her anymore.
Things
and if I try to
different.
Leave her, she's going to kill herself. So I'm stuck.
I'd be like, all right, I'll call
it's
you
a quagmire.
I'd be like, we'll see if you kill yourself, love. We'll see.
Well, we'll get to that. So throughout all this, he never stopped having extramarital affairs. He was cheating. And Barbara became more and more codependent on young Tony.
Oh, poor Tony.
So in 1967, the Bakelands moved from Paris to Switzerland. So now Tony's 20 years old. He's becoming a man.
Get to university, Tony. Get the fuck away from these people.
Well, he befriended a bisexual Australian man who made him very happy. They dated. They experimented with various hallucinogenics that were actually quite difficult to obtain in Switzerland. So they would often travel to Morocco to get their drugs and to get out to escape, you know, Barbara.
Yeah.
Who I imagine was like the worst helicopter mother of all time. So Barbara was a bit distrustful of the Aussie. She's a little older than her son, and she was wondering like what the nature is of the relationship.
And she's Australian.
But the distrust turned to hatred when Tony came out to his mother as gay.
I thought there was going to be an amazing moment where it's like it turned to hatred because she walked in and he was just like fucking bumming her son, like on their bed.
And she just started screaming.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that happened, but he came out to her as gay and introduced the Australian as his boyfriend.
Oh my God.
Barbara refused to acknowledge her son's sexual orientation. And she vowed to cure him one way or another.
No, Bob.
My handsome son. It reminds me of my mother on Mother's Day. I know we've told that story on the show.
I love that story. That's one of my favorites. I always make you tell that one.
Just a quick recap. When my mother, when I was like, I must have been eighth grade.
I was
13 when Jeffrey came out. And my mother and father took Jeffrey to the family psychologist, because we had one, because Jeff was kind of a bad kid. And Jeffrey, you know, came out to my parents then. And when they came back home, my father just kind of went along upstairs, was reading the Torah, doing rabbi things. And my mom just sat there just weeping. And the whole time she's like, my handsome son will never give me a child. And I was sitting there like, what the fuck? What am I? What's going on here?
You're the smart one. He's the handsome one.
My brother was handsome, though, back
Jeffrey
then.
Jeffrey was very handsome. Up until, I always call him the handsome one now, because he was.
He was very handsome, yeah. I mean, he's still a good-looking guy. So upon learning that Tony and his partner were going to Morocco and through Spain.
Oh, my God, on Bufti holidays.
Well, Barbara freaked out. And she's like, I'm going to Spain to get my son away from, you know, this homosexual. So they ended up being stopped at the border of Spain and Morocco because Tony didn't have his passport on hand.
Tony, come on. It's like the one thing you have to do when you're leaving the country is remember your fucking passport.
So Barbara confronted Tony and the Australian at the border and made such a scene that both Tony and his mom ended up getting arrested and spending a night in jail.
Oh, wow. Barbara knows how to throw a fit. I would love to have seen this woman and been at a party with her.
Well, a lot of people in Barbara's close circle said that this was the beginning of the end for the relationship with her son. So now they couldn't get back to Switzerland because they were in Spain and he didn't have his passport. So Barbara and Tony stayed in Spain. And there, Tony started hanging out with a young woman named Sylvie.
Okay.
Barbara was thinking, you know, this seems, it really did seem apparent that Tony wasn't interested in dating men and he liked Sylvie. They spent a lot of time together. However, she soon realized that the relationship between Tony and Sylvie was strictly platonic.
She was his beard/fag hack. Well, every gay man should have one.
Well, Sylvie was hanging out because she was having an affair with Brooks.
Oh!
Barbara's husband.
Oh, this is fantastic.
I know, this is so dramatic. It is great.
How is this not like a film? I can picture this all.
Well, it is a film.
Oh!
Yeah, there's a film called Savage Grace that came out in 2007 with Julianne Moore. I haven't seen it, but I was reading about it. I was going to chat about that at the end. So following this episode at the border and them staying in Spain, Brooks had reached his threshold with Barbara and her outbursts, her troubling behavior, her depression, her suicide threats. And he was like, I don't give a shit anymore.
Commit suicide.
And he called her bluff. So he filed for divorce and she didn't commit suicide. And he took Sylvie back with him to the U.S.
Oh, my God.
Ended up having a child with her.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe
started
Sylvie,
up a family.
Sylvie was the one finally.
Well, when Barbara found out about this,
oh,
she fell into a deep depression and she attempted to take her own life. But she was saved by a friend.
Oh, did she take like a handful of pills?
A handful of pills, yeah. And she was saved by a friend, rushed to a hospital, and ended up not committing suicide. So at this point, Barbara and Tony were just ejected from Brooks's new family life in America. He didn't want anything to do with his gay son and his mentalist wife.
Oh, wow.
So 21-year-old Tony, you know, was of no interest to his father, who lived with Sylvie and a young child. And whether Brooks had ever taken Tony in the past, he now thought of his first son, who had been already diagnosed with schizophrenia, as strange and peculiar as his mom.
He's definitely following her bloodline of mentalism.
And I think the father's like, I'm going to wash my hands clean of this. Get as far away as I can from these two mentalists.
I'm not saying I admire him, but after like 20 years of this, but at the end of the day, it's his own problem as well. Because I would have he's got all the money in the world. Why didn't he ship off Tony to all the best schools and be like, son, you must learn a trade. You must become an engineer. Like, why didn't he do any of this?
I think because of Barbara. It was Barbara
like
wanted
my
Barbara.
Darling
yeah,
son
I mean, it
mistake.
Was kind of like Barbara's raison d'être. Like she obsessed so heavily on this child that, you know, I think if he was gone, I think Barbara would have unraveled.
Even Joan Crawford sent Christina to boarding school, though.
Like. Well, so after the divorce, Barbara grew increasingly dependent and controlling of her son, and her main goal was to cure his homosexuality. So she would talk to her friends about it all the time, saying that she's determined to cure Tony. And so she often hired sex workers whom she paid to sexually assault her son.
Well, like attack him in the streets?
No, she would set him up in hotels with prostitutes.
Oh my God. But how would he get a Woody?
I don't think he would. I think they would try and he just wasn't interested. Well, this proved to be fruitless, obviously. So then Barbara began telling all of her friends that she was going to fix her son herself.
No.
It's a mother's love here. She proudly told everybody that she was routinely taking her son to bed, usually against his will and without his consent. You know, my mother tried this controversial technique on Jeffrey, and it only made him gayer. So I don't think it's going to work, all right? If you're going to learn one thing from this show. So rumors about this incestuous relationship ran rampant through their social circle.
If she's going to all the tea parties and saying, oh, I took him to bed. I've been taking him to bed every night. And, you know, I rape him. It's good for him. Tony, it's good for you, isn't it, son?
Yeah, but she's a wackadoo. She's an insane person. And her friends were like, this is just bullshit. This is the ramblings of an erratic, insane woman. And it's unclear as if there was any truth to what she was saying. And most of the friends didn't really believe her because she tended to say things like this to shock them all the time.
Okay. I would love to have met this woman.
Yeah. I mean, they thought she had pathological attention-seeking behavior. And so if she was being ignored, she'd make up some kind of shocking statement about her life so that they would pay attention to her.
Okay, so they're sick of Barbara's shit.
Well, she's clearly insane. But the deterioration of Tony's mental health, which was rapidly declining, was definitely not good. And I don't know if that's if whatever's transpiring between the mother and son, whether there's whether there's a sexual relationship, the prostitutes, or maybe his schizophrenia was worsening. But definitely that's not good. Doesn't bode well for the future. So the more Barbara controlled him, the more Tony would act out. And his behavior started becoming erratic. And he became angrier by the day, lashing out violently, like just prone to violent outbursts without a moment's notice. He started wearing black all the time. He was listening to My Chemical Romance. Joking, it was a few years before that. But Tony and Barbara, it was well known that they would get into screaming matches at each other, throwing things. And both were very paranoid of each other's actions. They ended up moving to London. And Tony and Barbara kind of acted like they lived together and they had a healthy relationship. But Tony definitely started growing very resentful of his mother.
Well, I would think so, because she's raping him. She's raping her child. How even without the schizophrenia, like, being resentful is like the least he can react to the rapes from his mother.
So one thing a lot of friends remember when they look back on their relationship, Tony went with Barbara to a dinner party where he attacked his mother as she left the friend's home. So he followed her to this dinner party, hung out outside, and when she left, he attacked her by pushing her into oncoming traffic. Well, she didn't end up getting hit by a car, and she ended up heading back home, and he ran back home after this. And so when she entered the house, he grabbed a kitchen knife, and he tried to attack her with it. And she fought him off, but he escaped out the back door and ran down a back alley to avoid causing any kind of more of a scene.
Would you, at that point, wouldn't you be like, I need to not live with my son who's going to fucking murder me?
Well, Bakelin didn't call the police. She didn't press charges, but she did make Tony go see a psychiatrist. Because I think there's an issue here. And so the psychiatrist was so alarmed by Tony's behavior and his admissions of hatred towards his mother that he reached out to Barbara and was like, I'm thinking your son might try to kill you. And he goes, I think you're at grave risk. Where Barbara said, I don't think that.
Oh, Barbara, you dumb, dumb bitch.
She didn't believe it. She loved her son. And she couldn't imagine him ever being able to do something like that.
This is Louise Bundy. isn't it? Oh, my son is just so wonderful, and he's a great lawyer, and he's just so lovely. He would never do anything to harm any woman in the world. It's like, fuck off, Louise.
Well, it's denial. I mean, it's classic denial. I don't think she really wanted to accept the fact. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think she wanted to accept the fact that her son was insane and her son hated her and she's a terrible mother. She obviously, you know, has depression and they're in this weird codependency relationship that isn't healthy. In her mind, she's thinking she's curing him of homosexuality, going to make him a better person. Meanwhile, she's traumatizing the kid and he hates her. And it all kind of came to a head on November 17th, 1972. So Tony and his mother argued over a friend who Tony had invited over to stay with them, but the mother didn't want to see this man.
Oh my God, it's the Australian, isn't it? It has to be the Australian. In my mind, it's the Australian.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't find out what happened to the Australian, but I'm assuming Tony had many friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he invited this one friend over, and the mother didn't want the friend to be there, and so Barbara put her foot down and was like, there's no way you're going to have this man in my house. And the argument became heated and it turned violent with Tony hitting his mother in the face.
Ooh.
She ran into the kitchen to hide from him. And it was at this point that Tony snapped. He grabbed a kitchen knife and just violently attacked her without hesitation. He just went into, you know, full on red primal rage.
Yeah.
And at the age of 51... Barbara Daly Bakelin was lying dead, bleeding out on the kitchen floor.
How many times did he stab her? Do you have that information?
It just said multiple times.
Oh, I imagine it was frenzied.
I imagine it was a frenzy. He probably broke bones stabbing her.
She was a pincushion, I think, by the end of this.
Well, interestingly enough, when police arrived at the scene, they found Tony, calm as a cucumber, in the bedroom ordering Chinese takeaway on the phone.
Oh God, British Chinese food.
British Chinese food.
This is like Ed Kemper though. Like once his mother had died, all his problems went away. This was it. Although he obviously carried on killing girls, but like his main hatred was his mother.
Well, I mean, Tony had admitted to attacking his mother, but he didn't realize that he killed her. He said, my mind was slightly wacky and I was very much under my mother's influence. I felt she was controlling me. No wire hangers. No wire hangers ever.
It's like Ed Kemper.
That's all he could hear. But I mean, I don't think he realized. He admitted that he stabbed her, but he was kind of like detached from reality. I mean, while he was in custody at Brixton, he would ask people that would show up like, so how's my mother doing? And he would ask, like, is she okay?
Oh, my God, son. She's really, really dead.
Well, at the Old Bailey, Tony was defended by the legendary John Mortimer. Do you know who that is?
I feel like I should do.
He's a famous British barrister who attempted to get Tony extradited back to the U.S. for treatment. But instead, Tony was found guilty of manslaughter, and he was institutionalized at Broadmoor Hospital.
Oh, wow, and put on all the good drugs.
Yeah, but that's where he received proper care for schizophrenia. I mean, he was formally diagnosed. He was receiving treatment. People might recall Broadmoor as the residence of Peter Sutcliffe, yeah. Yorkshire Ripper, Ronnie Cray,
yeah,
Charles Bronson.
Ooh, I bet Ronnie and Anthony probably were bumming each other.
You know, I'm sure he was a popular one.
Yeah, especially if he's good looking, a little bit mental. Just like Ronnie, I bet they had a little fun time together. Why not? You're at Broadmoor.
I mean, it sounded like Tony actually enjoyed his stay at Broadmoor, and he was doing much better with the medication. And it was, you know, friends and family started noticing because when they would visit him, because obviously because of his clout and his celebrity status, he would get a lot of visitors. And I think he was given special treatment compared to other people there, just because they have lots of money. But friends and family started petitioning for his release because they thought he had been, you know, at a point now he'd been rehabilitating and go back into normal society. So his maternal grandmother, Nini, this is Barbara's mother, took a very compassionate view of her grandson's troubles. And so she started going around to powerful family allies, such as the Hugo Money Coutts family, who's connected to the banking industry, connected to the Rockefellers, to steer a campaign to get Tony extradited back to the U.S. Nini loved her grandson, and she felt that under her supervision, if he was brought up properly, he could lead a normal, happy life.
You just already, she's like, oh, he just needs a woman's supervision. He's had a lot of that, and I think he'll crack. A
grandmother's love.
He's going to crack.
Grandmother's
if he,
love.
If he has any more woman's love.
Well, you sound a lot like the dad. So Tony's father, Brooks, was dead set against this, and he thought his son should have been found guilty of first-degree murder. He believed psychiatrists were a complete waste of time, and he described his son as evil.
Ooh.
Especially after Tony had started sending his young stepbrother macabre gifts that he had made himself while at Broadmoor. They don't go into detail about it, but I bet you it involved feces and rat skulls.
That's what you think. That's what you would make.
Well, what else does he have?
I would carve like little knives, like little wooden knives, and then I would carve like a dead woman, and I would write, This is for you, young stepbrother. This is your grandmother.
But I mean, he's not getting knives, so what is he making him?
Oh, yeah, you can't really carve. Well, you can carve shit. You can make shifts in,
like, paper plates with macaroni shells. Ooh, yeah, maybe, like, he weaved. Glued to it.
He
with
weaved.
Ketchup all over it.
Yeah, and that's what he got. Or he would draw pictures of dead Barbara with, well, a knife in her and send it off to
Brooks
him.
Brooks found the gifts very unsettling and was like, he's a psycho, and I don't think he should come back here. But 1980... After a couple years here of petitioning for his release, Nini finally got Tony released on the proviso that he would be under the duty and care of his 87-year-old grandmother.
Oh, this is stupid.
And and he'd be living in New York with her. The decision enraged Brooks, and he made attempts to thwart his son's release because he knew that Tony was capable of killing again. And this is the craziest thing, too. So this kid, you know, obviously was schizophrenic. He murdered his mother violently. And you'd think that, he would be, wrapped up like Dr. Lecter on a plane to come to the U.S. But they didn't even really care. They just, he was accompanied by one person who was the daughter of one of his grandmother's friends. Flew on a regular plane with everybody else.
Well, yeah, because these obviously have been extradited on under provisos.
Even psychiatrists at Broadmoor didn't think he should be released.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Well, he flew directly to New York City and ended up living with his grandmama. Well, within his first few days with his grandmother, Tony stopped taking his pills.
Oh, Tony.
He stopped taking his pills. Didn't feel that he needed medication for his schizophrenia. And he started doing some home crafts. He started building a shrine to his dead mother and would mumble satanic prayers over his ashes. Like, he would have his own satanic masses.
This is pretty cool, though.
To the dead mother's shrine. Well, he started acting a little weird, a little bizarre. And the grandmother, ended up asking him to go to the family psychiatrist. And even the psychiatrist is like, you need to put this kid back into a hospital because this is inevitably going to lead to more violence.
He's wackadoo.
He is whacked, and you're not going to be able to take care of him. Well, July 27th, 1980, not even a week after he had landed in the U.S., Tony grew enraged with his grandmother. He wanted to make a phone call to London to get in touch with a friend.
Oh, it's the Australian.
And his grandmother wouldn't allow him to do that. So he took a knife from the kitchen and he attacked her, stabbed her 8 times.
Wow.
Broke several bones. And when the police arrived at the apartment to discover the carnage, Tony was complaining to them that she just won't die, despite the multiple stab wounds. And she was screaming the entire time. And he's like, she just won't die.
I'm surprised he didn't order the good Chinese food of New York compared to Britain. Like, Tony, if you like the British Chinese food, wait until you try American Chinese food. And plus, American Chinese food comes in those delightful little boxes.
It's way better.
It's way better, but it comes in those little boxes, the takeaway boxes. We don't have them in Britain. So every time I see one of them, I'm like, oh my God, I'm in America.
Don't you guys still have styrofoam boxes, don't you?
Or like plastic boxes.
Yeah, plastic.
You know what we have, though, Chinese takeaway-wise, which I think Americans would love? We have munchie boxes.
Oh, yeah. We had one of those.
No, we didn't have a munchie box. You went into it, the idea of it.
I thought we went somewhere and got munchie. I know we had the spicy chips.
Oh, yeah. I love Chinese really chips good. In Britain. But no, we've never had a munchie box together, sadly.
Well, so as he was being interrogated by the police, He mentioned, he confessed that he wanted to have sex with his 87-year-old grandmother, but then he felt it'd be kinder for him just to kill her.
Okay, Anthony.
Well, believe it or not, Nini survived.
Oh, she's a tough old broad.
But she didn't want to raise the kid anymore.
Yeah, was she like, it was a bad idea of mine.
Well, regardless of how she might have thought about parenting, Tony was charged with attempted murder and he was sent to Rikers Island to wait his trial. And this time, in contrast to before, there really were no rich, influential people, you know, clamoring to defend Tony's right to freedom here. And he was incarcerated for life at Rikers Island. But he also had a bit of special privileges there, too, because of money. And he had a merry-go-round of sexual partners, protectors, people would give him money, and, you know, and prison officials who would do him favors.
Yeah, wow.
So he definitely had special treatment. But he was undergoing 8 months of psychiatric assessments because they were trying to decide whether or not they could send him back to Broadmoor. And so they'd been waiting for his medical records from Broadmoor to find out whether or not he should be in a prison or if he should be in a mental institution. But it had taken a really long time. There was a delay. And so March 20th, 1981, Tony was upset that he was still at Rikers and hadn't been transferred back to London. And at 3:30, he was found dead with a plastic bag wrapped tightly around his head.
Oh, shit. He took his own life.
Well, what's interesting about this, though, it's kind of a sinister act of possibly unintentional irony that his family's wealth was based on the plastic that he ended up using to kill himself.
Wait, was he having a weird wank maybe and then it just went a bit wrong?
I don't know. I
mean, because he seems like a weird wanker.
You know, they said his violent death, his suicide here, had not been verified as either suicide or murder, and it's still a mystery. So maybe.
Yeah.
Could have autoironically asphyxiated himself.
Well, there's no way that Rikers would ever say, oh yeah, that's suicide, because then it means they've dropped the bollock. But if they say he was, you know, shagging somebody and they were into BDSM and maybe things went a bit weird, then they're not complicit, are they? So there's no way Rikers would stand up and be like, yeah, you know.
It's just a weird way to kill yourself, though. Put a plastic bag over your head.
Especially as you're choking. He must have like sellotaped it or taped it down, because you would claw it off, you would think.
Yeah, you'd think so. Or maybe someone grabbed him and put the plastic bag over his head.
Or he could have also
or it could have been a sex thing.
Or it could have been a weird wank that went wrong. That's what I'm thinking. I want to believe that Tony died by weird wanking.
Yeah. Well, in an epitaph written by Brooks Bakelin, he called his son an enormous failure of intelligence.
Oh my God, Dad!
That's the
Holy
epitaph.
Shit.
I wonder if that's actually on his grave.
Oh, I should look it up and find a grave.
Imagine
find that. If it is. Well, this is a grave we would have to visit if it is.
Well, so later in 2007, the film Savage Grace came out, which is based on the life of Barbara and Tony. It starts with Tony's birth, and then it follows the family at the time of Tony's arrest for the murder of the mother. It stars Julianne Moore, Stephen DeLane, and Eddie Redmayne.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, who played, didn't he play Stephen Hawking, Eddie Redmayne?
He did. Oh, so I can totally
picture
this movie. He
plays Tony.
Do we see do we see Julianne Moore totally naked? She's hot.
Possibly, because I was reading about this. I looked it up, and apparently after the film opened, Barbara Bakelin's former lover, Samuel Adams Green, wrote an article pointing out elements in the film that could be misleading for those trying to read back to the reality that inspired it. In particular, he referred to a menage a trois scene, which depicted Barbara, Tony, and Sam in bed together having sex.
Ooh.
And so Sam Green wrote, "It's true that almost 40 years ago, I did have an affair with Barbara, but I certainly never slept with her son, nor am I bisexual. She started telling people that she had an incestuous relationship with her son as a way of curing him of homosexuality. But I don't believe she actually had sex with Tony. I just think she enjoyed shocking people."
Well,
but then
the truth remains to be seen for that.
Well, then he filed a lawsuit against the filmmakers, which was still unresolved at the time of his death. So I don't know what came out of it. But now I want to see this movie.
I want to see it too.
Yeah. I'll have to see if we can find it. I've never even heard of it, actually.
I love Julianne Moore.
Yeah, she's great. And Eddie Redmayne's a good actor. So I'll have to check it out. But there you go. A story of a mother's love. She loved her son so much that she gave her life trying to cure his homosexuality. How many moms would do that?
Well, would you let your son hump your arm if he wanted to hump your arm?
No. And I think that's the problem. If she would have stopped her son from humping her arm, then this might never have happened. She might still be alive to this day.
I think it's fine to let your sons hump your arm.
And that's the lesson you should learn from this show.
It is.
Don't let your cat hump your arm.
No, let them. It's fine.
People, this is episode 945 here is Sick and Wrong. Got a couple phone calls coming up next. You can call the Sick and Wrong hotline at 323-522-4032. But first, let me play this quick promo from Adam and Eve.
Hey, guys. It's me, Stephen. I'm a huge fan of your show. Thanks to your awesome coupon code, Diddle, I can buy myself loads of good sex toys. Since both of my wives died, and my Lou Gehrig's disease got pretty bad, let's just say things in the bedroom got pretty boring. But thanks to AdamandEve.com and coupon code Diddle, D-I-D-D-L-E, I am now a new man. Thanks.
Your charging power battery and now we are full of energy.
So we have a couple phone calls here to get to. The first call came from someone we haven't heard from quite some time, and one of your favorite callers, Marshall Island Tony.
I do have a soft spot for Marshall Island Tony.
Yeah, I was wondering what was going on with Tony. So anyway, he calls in about well, let's find out.
Hey, this is Tony. First of all, you were talking about Boeing a month or so ago, and I used to work as an airline mechanic, so remember that next time you're 10,000 meters above terra firma, but
I'm never flying again.
I trust Marshall and Tony with my hardware. Don't you?
I don't know. I wouldn't trust him with my cat, that's for sure.
I could tell right away you got some things wrong. For example, the tape on the wings, that was an authorized temporary repair because of problems with the paint. Nothing to do with the structure of the aircraft. Nobody would go that far. There are some other things, but, you know, it's always the Jews spreading lies and discontent.
He's right.
So, moving on.
We actually shot those jets out of the sky with our space lasers. I don't know if anyone told you about this, and maybe I'm divulging too much information. The Jewish mafia is going to take me out.
They are. They're going to come to the house later on tonight.
But it was space lasers, not Boeing.
Before I was telling you about a bar I used to work at in Japan, this place was actually a restaurant during the day and a nightclub at night. So every night we'd move a bunch of these tables and chairs onto this big internal stairwell they had to clear a dance floor. But you'd be happy to know that these tables and chairs didn't go to waste in the evenings, because we'd bring the ladies onto the stairwell in the evenings sometimes for what kind of special brand of customer service. For example, I remember one night I brought this one up there. And she bobbed the knob and I got her pretty good, but
Wait, she said she bobbed the knob?
She bobbed the knob.
Got cheap at the end and spit it on the floor. And of course this stairwell floor was totally filthy. Nobody ever cleaned it. So it's just like this. She made this, you know.
Just like years of cum, of like dried up cum on this sticky stairwell floor.
You know, I would actually be really insulted if a Japanese girl spit out my cum, because those fuckers eat like natto.
They eat what?
Natto.
Is that like Japanese nachos?
No, it's like a fermented like bean that's really sticky and globby. And they eat
it's like
that.
The same consistency
and they're
as
like,
cum.
They're like, oh, this is delicacy. I'd be like, yeah, so's cum. Don't fucking spit it out. It's so rude. You know what? Even when the cum is disgusting, it's rude to spit it out. You just swallow it and you go about
Maybe it's
day.
A customary thing there, though.
What, to spit out the cum?
Yeah,
but then
know.
They'll eat fucking what? They'll eat sperm whales and that's palatable.
Well,
but
that's probably fine. It's just, it's a cultural thing, you know?
Blackish, grayish, slimy mess on the floor. Rather unpleasant looking. Anyway, just as I'm zipping back up, getting ready to go out. The manager comes bounding up the stairs, and he says to me, you know, go up, get out there, you're working the bar the rest of the night, which was a punishment, because of course we like to work the floor in other areas where we could interact more. But he also said, clean up your mess. And I'm not sure what exactly he was referring to, if he saw it, seen the mess she made or not, but I just took one of those restaurant sofa chairs and just kind of rubbed it out for good measure. No harm, no foul. But I wonder, since I was technically on the clock and getting paid during those little encounters, does that make me a whore? Maybe in your wisdom you can answer that later.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a role reversal. Or are they both? Well, he wasn't paying the girl, right? He was just getting a knob job.
Yeah, bobbing on the knob. Yes, Tony, you're a haw. Is that what you want to hear? You are a male prostitute. You're a gigolo.
A gigolo. Well, that's so. This bar. I wonder if this place is still around.
Well, you're
that's
not what I'd like to know. It, so I don't no,
I'm just,
you
I'm just
know.
Curious if a place like this would be condoned in modern Tokyo. I mean, this is probably. Yeah, but I wonder how many bars you could just go. I guess when you work at a bar like this, especially when you work at a strip club, you can get blowjobs pretty easily.
Yeah, see, it's just the same kind
so
of
thing. So it's probably the same kind of thing. I'm surprised they didn't have like CCTV up or something.
These women eat fish heads and they won't swallow comb. You see the hypocrisy?
They eat horse.
They eat horse. They'll eat a horse's cock, but they won't swallow.
Maybe they don't like gaijin cum.
Ooh, was she insulting him by
not
swallowing
it? Yeah, maybe she was just
it?
Like, I'm not gonna drink your white cum.
Ooh, the white devil's cum. I
yeah,
see.
Maybe that's what it is. Anyway, Tony, good to hear from you.
Always.
And I'm curious, what was the name of this bar? And does it still exist? And give me the address, please. You can email me. All right, next call we have is a girl calling in about the Hollywood Bowl traffic, which is something that is definitely like a personal crisis for me.
Oh, this is an LA, a very LA call to moan
about
traffic.
I rant about this. I think I was ranting to you about this very week.
You were, because you were like an hour late.
Yeah. Let's hear what she has to say first.
D&K, what is up? First and foremost, I just want to thank you guys. Can't thank you enough. You literally keep me from fucking ending it all. Had a really shitty day at work, and now I'm sitting in Hollywood Bowl traffic. You guys know exactly what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
For people that don't know what the Hollywood Bowl traffic is, it's fucking bullshit. It's taking me 30 minutes to go one motherfucking mile, and I'm going to lose my fucking shit. Anyways, then I started listening to you guys talk about the guinea pig, which was hilarious, and how your mom said it was a mitzvah to give away the guinea pig. And I agree with her, because Hashem always protects. And because you gave away that guinea pig, the guinea pigs do in fact suck. I have a guinea pig named Pig Pig, who I also
pig
fucking
pig.
Hated. Because that motherfucker would keep you up all night. So
yeah, they fucking suck. They're the worst pets ever.
No, I can think of worse pets.
Not Caliban.
They're
terrible animals to own. You should never allow your kid to have a guinea pig.
I want to say this about LA traffic. This is what I think, like, there's many, like, retarded levels to LA, but this is probably the most retarded, that any other city in the world, you'd be like, oh, I know that this part is going to be pretty busy right now, so maybe I'll take a couple of B streets, I'll take a couple of C streets, I'll maybe have to drive 10 minutes extra out my way, but you know, I'll get there in a different... LA's like, you can't. This is the only way you can go.
This way. This is spoken from someone who doesn't know how to drive.
I fucking have been... There's like maybe two ways you can go, and each way is horrendous.
You'll learn once you actually know how
to
drive
learn.
That all these side streets, everybody's taking them. That's what Waze does. Waze redirects you. So it doesn't matter. There's so much traffic that there's nowhere you can go.
Build more fucking roads.
I mean, it'd be great if you could, but there's just so much traffic, there's no way you can go. And the worst part about the fucking Hollywood Bowl, I also have to go on Highland, right next to the Hollywood Bowl. It's a big concert venue here. I'm my way back from work. It's part of my commute. And so if I just go from my work to the Hollywood, like through Highland by the Hollywood Bowl all the way back here, it's about 26 minutes. But if there's a fucking concert there, It could take me an hour and a half to get home.
Why don't you just drive around?
Minutes. Well, because I'll save a lot of time. If I have to drive around, it's going to add an extra 10 to 15 minutes to the drive. So usually what happens is I'll, you know, go on Waze and I'll look, and Waze will be like, you know, you should redirect and go up Vine or something. It just takes a little longer. But the other day, I don't know, I was driving. I didn't even think about it because it's like a Tuesday. And so I fucking get off at Highland, and right when I like go off the exit, I just see like, I don't know, 300 cars. I'm like, fuck. And there's no going back because you're going up, it's off the freeway, and I'm just stuck there. And I'm just moving really slowly. And as I get up, this was on, what was this, like 2 weeks ago? As I get up, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I'm looking around, I'm like, is there, because it's early. You know, this was probably, yeah, like 2 weeks ago. I was like, it's early. That for the Hollywood Bowl to start having shows, you know, concerts midweek. Usually I can understand Thursday or Friday. I avoid that area on Thursday or Friday, but I figured like a Tuesday would be fine. And then I just start seeing all these white people, like not even middle-aged white people, just an assortment of white people of varying ages wearing parrot hats. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, what the fuck is, oh my God. Jimmy Buffett. It was a Jimmy Buffett memorial at the Hollywood Bowl. And the whole place, it was the first show of the summer, 2024, and it was packed. It took me, I don't know, probably about an hour to go a mile.
Sometimes I think, where are the mass shooters? Like, where are you? What are you doing? Because this would have been a great event, and you would have also taken...
I was about to be one.
Well, they would have taken out people that nobody really cares for, because if somebody is a Jimmy Buffett fan, like, you shouldn't be proud or announce that, and it's probably better that you are dead. Right?
You put them out of their misery. Fucking Jimmy Buffett. All these dickheads wearing Hawaiian shirts with parrot hats.
That would look.
I was enraged. I like rolled down my windows. My windows are tinted so you couldn't see me. Rolled down my windows and I was just screaming while flipping all of them off. And I couldn't go anywhere. They're just looking at me like, what is this man doing? He's like losing it in his car. I was
been like
so
falling
mad.
Down.
Yeah, it was full on falling down. I was like blasting like fucking Bathory or something. I was so angry. And then I think I even talked to you on the phone during it.
You did. I rang you.
Because I was trapped. And I was just so mad. I was cursing. Yeah, it was terrible. And then fucking repeat on Tuesday when I was going home. Same deal. I was driving down there and it was like, all this, not as much traffic as Jimmy Buffett, mind you, but there's a lot of traffic. I'm like, what the fuck's going on? Seth Rogen smokes the bowl.
Again, another perfect opportunity for a mass shooter. Although I can really see the crime scene photos of the Jimmy Buffett, you know, everyone with their parrot hats and the Hawaiian shirts.
Just covered in blood.
You wouldn't know where the blood or the Hawaiian print began. It would have been magnificent.
It would have been great.
It would have been fantastic. But, you know, people miss their opportunities. They don't dream anymore.
I just don't get Seth Rogen. It's like, dude, we know you smoke fucking weed. So does everybody else. You're not that special. We don't give a shit.
Seth Rogen is a no-lipped cunt. He has no lips. You should never trust a man with no lips. And plus, he's nowhere near as attractive as James Franco. I don't care what James Franco did. He's beautiful.
But it's just like he's... His claim to fame is he smokes a lot of fucking marijuana. And I guess he like came out on the bowl. I saw like reels going around of him like using a fucking torch to light this big massive bong. And you know, it's like, and everyone's like, oh, Seth Rogen smokes a bowl. It's like, who gives a shit?
Yeah,
you smoke
weed. He's not Snoop Dogg. Like, he's not remotely cool.
I don't know. I hate the guy.
I don't
But
like
yeah,
Seth
I was
Rogen
in
either.
I was in traffic for about probably 40 minutes that time, maybe a half an hour, but the Jimmy Buffett really had me enraged. I had like my fucking, I had veins in my forehead just popping. I was very upset.
I protected you when you gave away that guinea pig by protecting your sleep. So yeah, that's what
it didn't protect me from getting in fucking stuck in traffic outside a Jimmy Buffett concert.
Didn't protect you from getting Caliban.
Oh, that was a blessing.
And the other thing I want to say is, yes, we need to do a WeHo meetup. I think we're overdue. All right, keep it sick, keep it wrong. Fuck the guinea pigs and
fuck
Hollywood Bowl traffic.
The guinea pigs, right, and fuck Jimmy Buffett and Seth Rogen. I agree with you on that. And you know what? I also
Thank
agree
you,
with her. We should do an LA meetup. And, you know, I never really think we don't do meetups all that often. You know, if people do come and visit LA, if we're around, we'll try to make a point to go hang out.
Oh, my God. Should we do it when Claudia's here at the Rainbow?
Yeah, maybe we should do like
we'll run it by Claudia and see.
I don't know how many LA people would even show up, but it might be kind of fun just to go have a couple of drinks.
If Claudia's up some for LA it, people. We'll do it at the Rainbow.
I know there are a few LA fans that have been listening to us for years, so it might be a good time. So we'll look into that.
Please no mass shootings on that day.
Yeah.
Not that day.
And don't wear a fucking parrot hat. You can call the Stick Around Hotline, 323-522-4032, or just email us an MP3 at stickaroundpodcast@gmail.com. Once again, thank you to everybody out there who supports us on Patreon and Apple Podcasts. You keep this show going, and we do appreciate it. Patreon.com/sickandwrong. Definitely appreciate you helping the show. And if you want to buy some TeePublic, some Sick and Wrong merch at the TeePublic store, you can head on over to our website, sickandwrongpodcast.com/shop. Click on the picture of the Pope. I'm currently working on new designs, actually. If you want to wait, I got this Miller High Life design that I'm making.
Yeah, our whole thing about getting people to design stuff for us, and then the team is going to imagine the designs. Yeah, this team might just be chimps.
Yeah, I don't know. So I told them just this Miller High Life design, and what they sent me was so piss poor that I had to mock it up myself. But I'm still going to send over the other designs that some of the listeners have suggested just to get their response.
See, I wonder if it's even a real person or if it's AI. It's a chimp.
We'll have to find out. But if you want to buy some merch, head on over to the TeePublic store. Finally here, Sick and Wrong Song of the Week. I was gutted to find out a musician and a producer I greatly admire died this past Tuesday. Steve Albini. He died too soon. He's only 61 years old.
Yes, I'm sad about it too. But what I feel sadder for is the wave of middle-aged men who have been bereft by this news. I was sad over Machine Gun Thompson. That was sad for me.
Yeah, Dennis Thompson from MC5. Fuck, that's yeah, a bummer. But Steve Albini, he definitely inspired a lot of us back then. I mean, the 90s. He produced some of my favorite records.
Yeah.
And he definitely had like a sound, you know, that he developed a sound that no one else really had.
Steve's great, and he was super fair and like very funny. A curmudgeon.
He died of a heart attack at his home in Chicago while working on the new Shellac record that's coming out.
I imagine this was also Steve's not first heart attack, because it's kind of like Peter Sellers. You know, it took 9 heart attacks to finish off Peter Sellers, that they just became routine for him.
You know, he ran his recording studio from his home, Electrical Audio, that he ran since 97. But I mean, it's hard to like even describe his impact on underground music. I mean,
especially on men.
Touch and go. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people, women too, I love this guy's work. But you know what I love about Steve Albini? If Lance Wackerly was a music producer.
Yes.
It would be Steve Albini.
Yes.
Just the ultimate hater. And that was the thing with this guy. He was uncompromising with his total opposition to the commercialization of music. And one of his famous quotes is, if a record takes more than a week to make, somebody's fucking up.
He's fucking right, because it doesn't need, like, listen up, fucking Axl Rose and Fleetwood Mac Rumors. It doesn't need to take longer than that. It honestly doesn't.
None of it's being done right. And this guy like suffered no fools. He didn't even give a shit.
He would shit
on the bands whose records that he put out. And he would, I mean, he worked with them and he didn't even care. Chunklet magazine called him one of the 100 biggest assholes in rock.
Yeah, I totally get that. He's great. He was also a cat dad. And even for little bands, like this band that Asian babes used to know called Chud. I think they're from like Idaho or somewhere weird. But they went and recorded with him, and he was like, yeah, £1,000 for the whole weekend. Do you know how cheap that is?
That's the
to
thing.
To be mastered as well? Do you know how fucking cheap that is?
He said, I will charge a flat fee like a plumber, because that's what I'm doing here. I'm providing a service.
Yeah.
But, you know, people often forget about this too, because, I mean, he's produced so many seminal records. But, you know, he led two very raw, very atonal noise punk rock bands, Big Black, Rape Man, which was kind of like a one-off, and Shellac.
Yeah.
Which was probably his most successful. But, you know, people, you know him mostly as being a production engineer to like, he did all of Jesus Lizard's best records, Head, Goat, Liar, and Down. He did Nirvana's In Utero, PJ Harvey's Rid of Me.
Yeah, which is a great album.
Yeah, The Pixies' Surfer Rosa.
Which is not a great album.
Songs Ohio's Magnolia Electric Company, which is another amazing record. But he was still working with other bands. Like, he did Ty Segall. He worked with the drone metal band Sun. It was a very diverse, like, eclectic mix of bands. But true to his nature, he would work on these records. He'd make just an amazing-sounding record. And then just shit on it afterwards. So he described, this is my favorite thing about how he described the Pixies' debut, Surfer Rosa, which one of the greatest records that they've done. He called it a patchwork pinch loaf from a band who at their top dollar best are blandly entertaining college rock. And then he said their willingness to be guided by their manager, their record company, and their producers is unparalleled. Never have I seen four cows more anxious to be led around by their nose rings.
Oh my God, I love him.
You know, Frank Black didn't say anything about his death, but Kim Deal wrote Rest in Peace, Steve Albini.
Yeah, because I imagine him and Frank Black probably did not have a good working relationship because Frank Black is not a nice person.
He said, when I'm hired to record a band, I make it plain to my clients that I do not wish to be associated with their charming little records. I'll do a good job for them, but that does not include shouldering any responsibility for their lousy taste and mistakes.
He's great.
And he also had a strict moral code, like you were saying before. I mean, he would effectively negotiate, you know, his percentage, and he would not want anything to do with, you know, future profits of a record.
Yeah, because he's probably like, I don't want my name associated any further than this.
As he said it, he was like, an album is the band's creative work, and it's my job to help them manifest it. I'd like to be paid by a plumber. And so when Nirvana, who just came off the massive commercial success of Nevermind, Nirvana approached him, you know, because they, you know, they loved Steve Albini.
Oh,
and
yeah,
they approached him to do In Utero because Kurt Cobain hated Nevermind.
Well, yeah, because Nevermind is horrible. It's horrible sounding.
I like the record, but I mean, it was too overly produced for him, and it's not what he wanted it to sound like.
Of course.
You can even listen to rough cuts off of that. It doesn't sound like what he wanted it to sound like. And so he wanted a sound that Steve Albini was famous for. And so when he wrote to Nirvana specifying exactly what, you know, what he was going to do and how much his fees would be, Nirvana was like, are you sure you want to do this? He said he would just take $400,000, assuming the record, you know, would sell a few. But the record went on to sell over 50 million copies. So he missed out on millions of dollars. And he said, this is what Albini said, there's no fucking way I'd ever take that much money. I wouldn't be able to sleep. which is great. And it's not like he was loaded. I mean, how much money did Big Black, Rate Man, or Shellac really make?
I mean, they definitely made enough to that they could do international tours, especially Shellac.
Yeah, but I don't think he was like putting, you know, together massive records.
I just get the feeling he's like a type of guy who's like, money is fucking money. Like, I don't need to have like billions in the bank. Like, I'm just doing this for the curmudgeonly love of it.
Well, when In Utero came out, the record execs at DCG were so pissed off by it.
Oh, yeah, because they said there wasn't even a single hit on that. And that was the entire point.
They wanted another Nevermind.
Yeah.
So Albini ran a cooking blog. And he used to talk a lot of shit on that.
Oh, yeah, with his wife.
Well, he would talk a lot of shit about Steely Dan. Oh, he said it's music made for the sole purpose of letting the wedding band stretch out.
Don't you love Steely Dan?
Love Steely Dan. They're the best. They're the best. But yeah, you know what he really hated? This is hilarious, too. He hated electronic music, hated EDM. He said, I detest club culture as deeply as I detest anything on earth. And so this is a funny anecdote. When Diagonal label boss Oscar Powell emailed him asking if he could use like a super old sample of Albini's voice from like Big Black on the track, he just wanted like a yes or no. But Albini wrote a diatribe back to him about how much he hates dance music, hates club culture. He said, I've always detested mechanized dance music. It's stupid simplicity. The clubs where it was played, the people who went to the clubs, the drugs they took, the shit they talked about, the clothes they wore, the battles they fought against each other, all of it. 100% hated every scrap. And he said, but you can use a sample if you want. But that's the thing with the guy, you know, he never really raised his rates for people. And especially when, you know, it's the music world now. I mean, it's like it's harder for bands to make money. So it's like he was offering his service.
I think I always thought it was super cool of him to just be like, here's a recordable, and like you could record analog with him. It wasn't going to be fucking like, everything's going to be compressed and sounding clean.
He hated compression.
Yeah, because compression sucks.
He said he wished he could go back in time and kill the man who invented compression.
I'm 100% with him. Push everything into the red and then deal with it in mastering. That's the way you should do it. But like, he was cool. I really like Steve Albini. But he also died how he should have died.
A heart attack.
Like, I respect his death at the mixing
The mixing board, doing what he loved.
And he would have died just like so quickly. Like, I imagine his heart that is filled with hatred just like exploded.
It's the ultimate hater. Yeah. He was married to filmmaker Heather Winnow, who I don't know, but he wrote a cooking blog dedicated to her. He was a feisty gardener, excellent cook. Formidable poker player. Like, he played like national championships.
Well, you can see that though, because he's got very much a poker face.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that kind of mindset. He was a connoisseur of something he called fluffy coffee, which is a cappuccino with cinnamon and maple syrup.
Oh, okay.
And he also said that he happily prepares his wife whatever she wants for dinner each night. He says, I'm not picky. I just like making food for other people.
Oh, what a sweetheart.
He's a great guy. Yeah. And he definitely will be missed. So we're going to end the show here with a Big Black song called Bad Penny from one of my favorite Big Black records, Songs About Fucking.
Yeah.
Came out in 1987 on Touch and Go. It's a great cover of Kraftwerk's The Model on that record. Rest in power, Steve Albini, and happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. People, we'll be back next week with episode 946. Till then, take it sleazy.
Doing in this closet when I told you no wire.